what we've been doing for the last few weeks, just for the summer, is we've been looking at some of the most popular Bible stories in the Old Testament. Stories that maybe if you grew up, for whatever reason, you grew up in church, maybe you haven't heard them since you were a little kid in your Sunday school class where your teacher used the little felt board flannel graph and put the pictures up there and showed you, and then you colored in the coloring sheets, right? And maybe you made a little baby Moses basket out of paper, and then you put a lid on it, and you took the lid off, and you put the lid on, and you took the lid off. And maybe that was one of the crafts that you made, right? But maybe that was the last time you actually heard or reviewed some of these stories. We're going back and looking at them again and taking a second glance at them and seeing, okay, so we remember the kid details that we were taught when we were a kid. But we want to look at, why are these stories here? These aren't just stories. They're not just Bible stories. They're true accounts of real events, right? That they really happen. And they're in the Bible. They're there to teach us, about God and teach us about ourselves and who we are in relationship to God, and to draw us closer to Him. And the truths of these stories are timeless. They're always true, and they're there to give us a better understanding of God and our relationship with Him and who He is. And so that's why we want, just this summer, we're going to take a look at some of those most popular ones. And so we looked at a few stories in the last few weeks in the book of Genesis. Today we're going to start looking at a couple stories in the book of Exodus. So if you grab one of the Bibles in the back, whether the brown one or the black one, if you grab one of those, in the black Bible it's going to be on page 31. In the brown Bible, it's going to be on page 71, but we're going to be in Exodus chapter 2 this morning. Exodus chapter 2. We're actually going to also be in Exodus chapter 1, but I figure if you turn to 2, you can probably find one. But forgive me if I'm making too many assumptions. Again, in the black Bible, it's on page 31. In the brown Bible, it's on page 71. If you grab one of those Bibles this morning from the back and you don't have one yourself, you don't own one, that's yours. Take it. It's our gift to you. We don't want it back. We want you to be able to use that and investigate it. So while you're turning there, you may not have heard this story, not this one, this what I'm about to tell you. But I pay attention in the news to like really odd stories. If you use, now I don't want to start the debate between Bing and Google, but if you use Bing as your homepage, at the bottom it always shows you this list of news stories. And so that's basically where I get my news from, just these random stories that pop up, which is not a very good filter, but it gives me some pretty, it's always like random, odd, interesting news stories. So a while ago, and I say a while, but it doesn't even feel like a while ago, but 2008, that was 10 years ago, isn't that crazy? In 2008, though, there was this story about this guy named Anthony Curcio. Anthony Curcio was in some dire straits and decided that the solution to his problem was going to be to rob a bank. He is well known, at least amongst the crime community, as pulling off one of the most elaborate bank robberies in U.S. history. It's right up there at the top of elaborate bank robberies. So what he decided to do was he watched this Bank of America in Washington for months and watched the armored car drop off and pick up loads of cash. And so he watched it for a long time, and he developed this plan. And his plan was like I said, it was elaborate. His plan was he spent time dredging out by hand a local river, like in the river, digging out this river, so that there would be room enough for him to, because it was a shallow creek, right? So he digs it out so it would be deep enough so that he can put a raft in this river and then use the raft to get across it, weighted down by himself and all this money that he's going to put in this raft. So he dredges out this river by hand, installs a cable going from one end to the other end so he can actually pull himself across the river, not paddling, but pull himself across this river. He sets this all up. Then he puts an ad on Craigslist, and he's looking for 15 to 20 men to show up and help some city improvement work in the parking lot of Bank of America. Everybody must wear blue jeans, a blue shirt, an orange safety vest, a painter's mask, and a ball cap. This is in the, he's going to pay them $28.50 an hour. $28.50 an hour. If I saw that ad, I'd be like, huh, well, maybe, right? So that's a decent amount of money. But so he's looking for 15 to 20 men all wearing the same thing, right? And to show up at a very specific time at this bank, right as they're showing up in the same outfit with a wig on and all that, he walks up to this armored car, pepper sprays the security guard, takes $400,000 in cash, and then takes off. Starts running, gets in his raft, gets across the river, ditches his outfit, his costume, and makes off with his cash. And when the cops show up, they find 20 guys that look just like him. They said, this is, they call him the Craigslist robber, right? There's one of the most elaborate heists in U.S. history, apparently. I mean, he put a lot of planning into this, a lot of strategy into figuring this out. A month later, he was arrested. And the reason he was arrested is because while he was casing this for months, there was a homeless man watching him. And he wrote down his license plate just in case. He was caught. You can't plan for everything, right? Who would think that that would be the undoing? In this whole elaborate plan, who would think that the undoing would be this homeless guy that was just there every day too, watching him? But it just goes to show you can't plan for everything. In Exodus chapter 3, we're going to see an elaborate plan, but this one works out. And I want to talk about why this one works out. But this is Exodus chapter 2, and we're going to start in verses 1 and 2. Exodus chapter 2, verses 1 and 2. And this is, if you've not been in church much or it's been a while or whatever, this story may be familiar with you, the story of the birth of Moses. But even if it's not, that's okay. So Exodus chapter 2, verses 1 and 2 says this. Now a man of the tribe of Levi married a Levite woman, and she became pregnant and gave birth to a son. I know that's sudden, but we're going to stop there, right there. So this account starts with a small family. I want to tell you about this family, this man and this woman, tribe of Levi, right? The man, his name is Amram. I was talking with a couple of people the other day about Bible names and how Jacob went through his whole family. He's got all these crazy names, right? Zebulun, Issachar. And then I don't know if he runs out of names or he just gets to Dan. Right? He gets all these names and then Dan. But then you see this guy, right? Amram. And you're thinking, man, there's a lot of creative names in the Bible. But as I said last week, so my wife and I are not planning on having any more kids. So if you're going to have a son and you decide you want to name him Amram, we will not run into that situation where we meet each other again in 15 years and you're like, hey, meet my son Amram. And I'm like, oh, here's my son Amram. This is awkward. We chose the same name. Not going to happen. So go with it. So Amram is the dad. That's his name. Even worse, and I feel bad for her, but the mom's name here is Jochebed. So we have Amram and Jochebed, this loving couple. And not mentioned here, but will be mentioned later on in the book here, is that they already have two children. Amram and Jochebed already have two children. They have an older daughter named Miriam. She's 7. And they have a son who's their firstborn, and he's 3. His name is Aaron. So this is a small little family here, right? Amram, Jochebed, Miriam, Aaron. And I wonder if they name, like, Miriam and Aaron are not nearly as odd as Amram and Jochebed. And I wonder if they're like, listen, we're not doing to them what my parents did to me. We're giving them normal names, and that's how it's going to be. So they have this nice little family, right? And so we're told here in chapter 2, verse 2, that she becomes pregnant, right? And she gives birth to their third child, another boy. And we're going to learn later on that his name is Moses. This is Moses, this third child. But then the story takes an unusual turn. Look at verse 2. So she became pregnant, and she gave birth to a son. But when she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months. And so it takes an unusual turn. Jochebed, the mom, immediately upon his birth of her newborn son, she hides him. She hides Moses. And so the question that we want to look at first here is, what is going on here? Why in the world is she gives birth and then she immediately hides her son? So 350 years earlier, we talked about these guys last week, if you were here. If you weren't, that's okay. Jacob's has 12 sons. Jacob's 12 sons moved to Egypt, right, to live. Thanks to the leadership and guidance of their brother Joseph, who was one of the highest-ranking officials in Egypt at this time. And so you've got this family of 12 brothers, basically, who have moved to Egypt and are living there. They're all sons of the same man, Jacob, whose name also sometimes is Israel. He's got two names. And so they settle in the land of Goshen in Egypt, and that's part of the Nile River Delta. So you've got this family that's moved to Egypt in the Nile River Delta, this land called Goshen. It's one of the better lands that there is there in Egypt, more fertile than some of the other land. And they establish solid lives for themselves, this family does. And they grow. They have more kids. Their family expands and it gets larger and larger, right? Over this time, this 350 years. And so eventually they become so big and such an extended family, they become called the Israelites. The children of Israel. Israel is the other name for Jacob, right? So they become the Israelites. And they increase dramatically over these 350 years. So there's a lot of them. But a lot has changed. A lot has changed in that time since Jacob's 12 sons moved to Egypt. I want to show you Exodus chapter 1, verses 8 to 10. Verses 8 and 9 then through 10. So it says this, Exodus chapter 1, verse 8 says, and you can, if you glance over the page, it says, a new king to whom Joseph meant nothing came to power in Egypt. Verse 9, look, he said to his people, the Israelites have become far too numerous for us. Verse 10, come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous, and if war breaks out, will join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country. So a new pharaoh, it's probably this pharaoh, if you're not a student in history, that's okay. I'm a student in history, and so this fascinates me. So this new pharaoh, it's probably a pharaoh named Tutmose the First, and he is now ruling, and he doesn't care about Joseph. And he doesn't care about the legacy that Joseph's family has, these 12 guys, how great a relationship Joseph had with the previous pharaohs and how they were assured, man, if you come live here, you'll be accepted into our kingdom, you'll be accepted in our nation, you'll be a part of it just like we are. He doesn't care about that legacy. He's more concerned about having foreigners living in his land and how they're unhappy with it. And genuinely, there are foreigners living in his land, but they're living as equals. They're living like they're equal to the Egyptians. And so there's this phobia that develops in the Pharaoh and in the Egyptians of the time. Like, man, why are we letting these people live like they're one of us when they're not? Why are we letting them grow like this when they're not? And so they're worried about the threat that they represent too. They're not, they have no allegiance to Egypt. We don't know where their allegiance lies. And if something were to happen, we can't rely on them. We basically have all these sleeper agents in our back door. And if something happens, then they may join the other side. And so in an attempt to ease the threat that he sees there in all these foreigners, the Israelites in Egypt, the Pharaoh orders the subjugation and enslavement of them. He says, all right, so here's what we're going to do. We're going to enslave them. We're going to make them work, and we're going to make them less than our equals. And he takes it to the next level when he doesn't get the result he wants. And so he says, we're going to enslave them, but enslaving them doesn't stop them from multiplying and growing and being significant. So he takes it to the next level, Exodus chapter 1, verse 15. So the king of Egypt says to the Hebrew midwives, whose names were Shiphrah and Puah, when you, again, if you want those names, you got them. Those are yours too. Shiphrah and Puah, when you are helping the Hebrew women during childbirth on the delivery stool, if you see that the baby is a boy, kill him. But if it is a girl, let her live. So he takes it to the next level, right? The Pharaoh says, okay, he calls in these two chief midwives, Shiphrah and Puah, and he tells them to kill any boys that the Israelite, the Hebrew women, deliver. But let the girls live. Let the girls live. Why he only targets the boys and not the girls is kind of unknown. There's no specific obvious reason for it, but neither is known how long this command lasted for, how long they were told to do this, how long the threat existed there. The thought is that it was meant to be a strong deterrent to getting pregnant. It was a strong deterrent to getting pregnant, thus decreasing the numbers, because as a family, you have to have that serious discussion. If there's a 50% chance here they're going to kill our child, what is the smart, responsible thing to do as a parent then? We're not going to have kids. It's seen as a deterrent. Like, this will discourage them from having any more kids, right? And yes, in the process, we might also decrease the number of strong men. But really, you talk about family planning there. You have to take that into consideration when you're planning a family. Look, do we want to put ourselves in the position where this child is guaranteed to die if it's a boy? Is that the position we want to put ourselves in? However, the two midwives didn't obey Pharaoh's order. These are the, now these aren't the only two midwives. You can imagine their job is probably pretty busy if they're the only two Hebrew midwives. These are not the only two. These are just the two chief midwives that are in charge of all the other midwives, right? So they're responsible for any of the actions. And so what we find out is that the two midwives don't obey Pharaoh's order. They're not going to kill newborn boys. They're not going to do it. And so Pharaoh issues a new edict, chapter 1, verse 22. So Pharaoh gives this order, because the midwives, they make excuses, but they're not killing these boys. And so Pharaoh gives this order to all his people, not just the midwives now. This is to everyone. Every Hebrew boy that is born, you must throw into the Nile, but let every girl live. These are not just the midwives anymore. These are their neighbors. And they're told, look, if your neighbor has a baby and it's a boy, throw it in the Nile. If you are a Hebrew and you have a baby and it's a boy, throw it in the Nile. This is not just the midwives anymore. This isn't just for Egyptian soldiers either. This isn't just like, these are our soldiers, they're going to knock down your doors, right? This is for everybody. This is, I mean, the closest thing we can imagine to this is, and maybe you're already thinking it, is the Holocaust, where Germans were told you must turn in your Jewish neighbors. This is the closest thing we can imagine to it. This order is for everyone. So if you see or know of a newborn Hebrew baby boy, take him and throw him in the Nile. And it's not a suggestion. Keep in mind, the Egyptian people believed their Pharaoh was a god. And disobeying the divine was punishable by death. If you didn't do what he directly said, you must do this, you could be killed. You obeyed when he said to. Bottom line, that was the law. And once this order was issued, Hebrew baby boys began to die. Neighbors began to notice. And this is disgusting, and it's horrific. Babies are ripped out of their mother's arms and thrown into the river. Doors are kicked open as another baby boy is discovered. Furious struggles occur as fathers fail to restrain themselves, and mothers lose all sense of self-preservation for the sake of their son. People are killed for resisting Pharaoh's edict. And then Jochebed becomes pregnant and gives birth to a boy. We don't know when the edict was made in relation to Jochebed's pregnancy, whether it was made before she became pregnant or when she was pregnant. We don't know that. Its timing does raise questions. If the edict was made before she got pregnant, you have to wonder how that conversation might have gone then between Amram and Jochebed. They already have two children. Right, we already have a daughter and a son. Wouldn't you, if you knew the consequence of delivering a baby boy, wouldn't you practice abstinence? Wouldn't you make sure we don't put ourselves in this position where we have to live under this threat? Wouldn't you not risk it? And granted, I know there's always surprises, right? But if the edict was made while she was pregnant, does she hide that pregnancy for 9 months? Does she try to do her very best to hide that pregnancy? If she's found out, if they discover, oh, hey, Jochebed's pregnant, does she live in fear, worrying month after month as it gets closer and closer that she'll be under intense scrutiny to discover, is this a boy or a girl? Is she worried about people looking over her shoulder every day, wondering when is she going to give birth, and is this going to be a boy or a girl? We don't know when the edict was made. But it does raise a number of interesting questions. But what we do know is that when he was born, the edict was in effect. The midwives were faithful to God when she gave birth. They didn't kill Moses when Jochebed gave birth. But now the reality of the situation sets in. This beautiful, crying baby boy is crying and is loud and is a boy. And so we have to raise this baby then in secret. We have to hide him, and even more than that, we know that we now have to survive every day without being discovered. As parents, we have to survive every single day and live with the fear that maybe today is the day they discover my son. Because if they discover my son, they'll kill him, and they'll kill me, and they'll kill my husband, and they'll probably kill my daughter and my other son too. There's a lot at stake here. Josephus, the Jewish historian, records that for disobeying the Pharaoh's edict, at times whole families were executed for disobeying Pharaoh. This is why I think that the edict must have been made after she became pregnant. What husband and wife would knowingly put themselves in that position? What an awful choice to have to make. We can't kill our baby son, But by not killing him, we are risking our own lives, and we're risking the lives of our daughter and our other son too. So every day, they manage every day to keep their newborn boy hidden for his sake and for their sake for 3 months. If you've been around babies or had a child that young, Amelia, our daughter, is 3 months old, almost four, and I cannot imagine keeping her hidden, a secret, for this entire time. Verse 3. But when she could hide him no longer, she got a papyrus basket for him and coated it with tar and pitch. Then she placed the child in it and put it among the reeds along the bank of the Nile, and his sister stood at a distance to see what would happen to him. When Pharaoh's daughter went down to the Nile to bathe and her attendants were walking along the riverbank, she saw the basket among the reeds and sent her female slave to get it. She opened it and saw the baby. He was crying and she felt sorry for him. "This is one of the Hebrew babies," she said. So for 3 months, they keep their new little boy hidden. So here's my question. What's the plan, Jochebed? What's the plan? You can't keep this boy hidden forever, and at some point, someone is going to notice, hey, you have a third child. Where did this one come from? Where that little energetic boy running around, that toddler, where did he come from? Right? At some point, someone's going to notice, he's young enough to have been born during the edict. You must have disobeyed the edict. So what's the plan, Jochebed? You can't ever reveal this boy because they will know you disobeyed. And there are retroactive punishments for that. So what's the plan here? There's no way that this ends well, right? There's no way that this ends well. You can imagine for at least 3 months, if not 9 months, whenever this edict was made while she was pregnant, sitting up at night, Amram and Jochebed develop a plan. What are we going to do when this child is born if it's a boy? You imagine those nights after night after night worrying and wondering and trying to figure this out. What do we do? How are we going to raise a boy? People are going to know eventually that we disobeyed. There's serious consequences there. And so for however many months they're waiting for this boy, they develop a plan to save him. This is not an, oh no, he's sitting up and rolling over or he's teething, quick, grab a basket, we're going to put him out in the river. This isn't like a sudden, oh man, what do we do, right? This isn't that. This was planned. Jochebed makes a basket with a lid and she makes it watertight. You better believe she tests it. Parents, you're going to test this thing before you put your three-month-old baby in this basket in the middle of the Nile River, right? I'm going to put 15 pounds of rocks in it and put it out there in the river and make sure this thing doesn't sink. I'm not putting my three-month-old in a basket that I haven't tested yet, right? You better believe there is a plan. There's careful preparation for this. So she takes this basket that she's made and she's carefully prepared. She puts her baby in it, her son, her three-month-old son, and she puts it in the reeds. Now, sometimes when we hear this story, we get this idea. I don't know if you ever did this. This was always, maybe it's a boy thing. We always did this. We went down to, you choose your choice stick, or maybe you used a leaf, but you go down to the creek with your choice stick. Everybody, your friends choose their stick, and then on the count of three, you all drop them right into the creek, right? And then you race and run down the creek, watching your stick, right? Hoping it doesn't get caught up on branches and rocks and like, and the coolest part is when it hits the small rapids and it's right, to see whose stick crosses the bridge or the finish line first, right? Maybe that was just me. Maybe that was my weird entertainment when I was a kid, but we did that. And there's still some times where with the boys, I'm like, hey, let's drop sticks in this creek. And they're like, why? Because they'll race and it's fun, right? So, but this is not put the basket in and then take off and see where it ends, right? She's not, but this is the Nile River, right? You put this in the wrong place in the Nile River and that baby's gone. She puts it in the reeds, right? She's not chasing this down the river, hoping that it stops somewhere, right? Or I don't know if you've ever done that plastic bag that blows by sometimes and you have that crisis of action where you're like, do I look like a fool trying to catch this plastic bag that's blowing through the parking lot, right? Or do I just kind of leave it, right? Or are you trying to do the stomp thing where you put, right? And you're chasing this thing down. This is not her chasing this basket down the river, right? She places it in the reeds. She doesn't work for 3 months to save this boy's life just to push him out in the current of the mighty Nile, the second biggest river in the world, and then hope for the best. This isn't that. No, she places him in the reeds, but she's not hiding him in a new hiding spot. That's also not what this is. She's not hiding him in a new hiding spot, and she's not put him out there to wait for hours, hungry and crying and making a mess in his basket under the Egyptian sun. That's irresponsible too. This isn't that. No, this spot and this timing were chosen because this is the spot and the time where Pharaoh's daughter often goes to bathe. This is so interesting and so cool. This woman, this daughter, this Pharaoh's daughter, is Hatshepsut. She's daughter of Thutmose I, the Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, the god of the Egyptians. She was the only full-blooded child of this Pharaoh. He didn't have any sons yet. She's the only full-blooded child of the Pharaoh, and so it was through her and her husband, Thutmose II, it's through her and her husband that the royal line of pharaohs would continue. What's important to know about her, though, for this situation, is that Hatshepsut has a daughter, but after her daughter's birth, she's unable to bear any more children, especially a son. Hatshepsut has no kids, has no heir to the Pharaoh's throne. So, as she always does, Hatshepsut goes to the Nile to bathe. And this is a religious time for her, too. Going down there. It's a religious time for her. The Nile was representative of one of the chief deities that the Egyptians worshipped. The Nile was the source of life for Egypt. So it is very likely that these were fertility treatments for her. She's going down to this river, bathing in the river of life, hoping for a son. Bathing in the Nile every day, often. And on this day, when she goes to bathe, she sees a basket, which is what Moses' sister Miriam, who's 7 years old, is watching for from a distance. Verse 4. His sister stood at a distance to see what would happen to him. Verse 5. Then Pharaoh's daughter went down to the Nile to bathe, and her attendants there were walking along the riverbank, and she saw the basket among the reeds and sent her female slave to get it. So Miriam is 7 years old, watching this from a distance. It's part of the plan that Amram and Jochebed have made to save their son. A plan they committed to 100% when they put that basket in the sight of the princess. They committed to this plan. Miriam will watch, and her role will be crucial in the moments after discovery. Verse 6, she opens it and saw the baby. He was crying, and she felt sorry for him. This is one of the Hebrew babies, she said. This is what Miriam is watching for, right? When Hatshepsut opens the basket and she sees Moses, Moses is crying, right? So he has not been out there for a long time, because after babies mess and get hungry, right, they'll do it again fairly soon after you change them and feed them, right? And so we're talking, he maybe has been out there for an hour. She's waiting and watching, right? And when she opens this basket, he's crying. And what this is a lot of responsibility for Miriam, his 7-year-old sister, to watch this happen. She knows the steps that have to follow after this, but this is the terrifying moment of faith, because it is entirely possible, or what Amram and Jochebed can't know, is how the princess is going to react knowing her father's decree. It is entirely possible that she opens this basket, sees this baby boy, picks him up, and throws him into the river. There is that possibility. Imagine the anxiety Miriam, this 7-year-old, must have felt, the shaky hands and the sick feeling in her stomach as she watches the princess open the basket. Imagine Amram and Jochebed at home waiting and waiting in their house, anxiety-ridden, for Miriam to return. What news is Miriam going to bring when she comes back? Is their baby dead? But Hatshepsut felt sorry for this crying little baby, maybe because of her inability to have a son. And here is this beautiful baby boy, a gift from the Nile. the giver of life in her mind. Verse 7. His sister then asks Pharaoh's daughter. So between verse 6 and verse 7, Miriam sees her pull this baby out. She doesn't throw him in the river, and Miriam takes off, running straight for the princess. And she says to her, "Should I go and get one of the Hebrew women to nurse the baby for you?" "Yes, go," she answered. So the girl went and got the baby's mother. Verse 9, Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this baby and nurse him for me, and I will pay you." So the woman took the baby and nursed him. Whatever she was thinking, interrupting her thoughts, is little 7-year-old Miriam, whatever this Pharaoh's daughter, whatever Hatshepsut was thinking when she saw this little baby boy, interrupting her thoughts is little 7-year-old Miriam, maybe pulling on her dress, who happens to wander up while she's holding Moses and asks the princess a question, probably rehearsed over and over and over again. "Miriam, tell me what you're going to say. Tell me what you're going to say. Don't forget it. Tell me what you're going to say. What are you supposed to ask?" Right? Rehearsed over and over with her mom as they go over the plan, and then in the reeds in her mind as she watches. Rehearsing this in her mind as she watches from the reeds and waits. "Do you want me to go get a Hebrew woman who can nurse this baby?" Imagine the moment that Miriam opens the door of their house and Amram and Jochebed look up, terrified in anticipation of that moment. Good or bad? Good or bad? And Miriam tells her mom everything and brings her, and I guarantee she runs to her son, who has just been saved and guaranteed a long life. Not just a long life, the best life. And on top of that, she gets paid to raise him. Verse 10, when the child grew older, she took him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. And she named him Moses, saying, "I drew him out of the water." So when he gets older, we don't know when this was. Guesses range from 2.5 to 5. And some say, well, once he's weaned, then he goes and becomes raised by the Pharaoh's daughter. But there are a lot of other traditions and historical records that suggest that the Pharaohs and their daughters and the royalty wouldn't raise their kids until they were 5 years old. And so it's very possible that Jochebed gets to spend 5 years with this little boy. But after that time, whatever age, he was returned to Pharaoh's daughter, at which point she names him Moses, which is Hebrew for drawn out. But this is also really cool, because Mose is Egyptian for child of. She literally names him in both Hebrew and Egyptian, child of the river. Child of the river. He's adopted into Pharaoh's family. He becomes the adopted son of Pharaoh's daughter. He becomes Pharaoh's grandson. He will eventually have a stepbrother, not born from his mom, but from his adopted father's second wife. That brother, his name will be Thutmose III. He will eventually become the Pharaoh that Moses must confront to release the Hebrews from their slavery. This is very much a family affair. But that's years down the road. For now, Moses is safe and being raised in the most royal of homes. So what's the lesson here? What is the lesson here? Last week, through the story of Joseph, we learned that what can comfort us in our worst times, in our own pits. Remember, Joseph was in the bottom of that pit, listening to his brothers plot his murder or enslavement. And we learned that we can be comforted that God is in control and we can trust him with the outcome. God is in control. We can trust him with the outcome, that he works things for good for those who love him, which definitely helps when faced with impossible situations that are outside of our control, or tragedies or struggles. What does faith do? Faith rests in the fact that God is in control and we can trust him with the outcome. But what about when we have a choice to make? What about when we're in an impossible situation and we have to make a choice? When we're faced with a crisis, with a tough situation, but there's got to be a decision made, and we have to be the ones to make that decision. What do we do then? Well, I want you to see what the author of Hebrews says about Amram and Jochebed in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 23. It says this, "By faith, Moses' parents hid him for 3 months after he was born, because they saw he was no ordinary child, and they were not afraid of the king's edict." This story in Exodus chapter 2, verses 1 to 10, isn't about Moses. It's about his parents. Hebrews 11:23 confirms that and emphasizes that for us. This story is about his parents and their faith. They faced a crisis of uncertainty. What do we do? What do we do? Some people would say, well, faith would just go on with life, have the baby, no need to hide him. That's bold faith. That's bold faith. I would say respectfully, no, that's stupidity. You know what the result would be of that course of action. You know what will happen if you do that. What Amram and Jochebed did was make the best decision they could. They made a plan using the human wisdom that God gave them, and man, was it an elaborate plan. But the writer of Hebrews calls it faith. They made a plan, and we just saw the elaborateness of that plan. There was a lot involved there. If we're going to do it at this time, we're going to make this boat, and you're going to say this, and I'm going to be ready, and right, it's an elaborate plan. But the author of Hebrews calls it faith, because ultimately, no matter what the plan is, it comes down to trusting God with the result. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 6 explains faith in this way. It says, without faith, it's impossible to please God, because anyone who comes to him must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who earnestly seek him, pursue him. It explains faith as believing in God and that God will reward you for passionately pursuing him. Which is what Moses' parents were doing in this crisis, in this significant time of uncertainty. What do? Based on their belief, we believe God exists, right? And he will reward us for pursuing him, for pursuing what he stands for loving him. So they made a plan and they committed it to God. This is what we're going to do, God. We trust you with the outcome. They did what they believed was right. They acted in faith and they trusted God with the result. Some of my favorite verses in the Psalms are helpful for us to understand this truth. Imagine, I want you to imagine, as we read this, I want you to imagine as though they're written to Amram and Jochebed as they struggle with the decision that they're facing. Psalm 37, verses 3-5 says, trust in the Lord and do good. Dwell in the land and cultivate faithfulness. Delight yourself in the Lord and he will give you the desires of your heart. Commit your way to the Lord. Trust also in him, and he will do it. He will bring forth your righteousness as the light and your judgment as the noonday. Think about this. Amram, Jochebed, trust God and live rightly. Live a righteous life. No matter where God has you in life, live in that land that he has you in and cultivate faithfulness. Be faithful to God where he has you, Amram. Jochebed, delight in God, pursue him, crave him, because he rewards those who do. He will give you the desires of your heart so you can commit your plan to God, trust in him, and he will take care of the rest. He will reward your righteous pursuit of him in the most brilliant and the most dynamic way. And isn't that what God did for them? They took that plan and they committed it to God. And he rewarded them in the most brilliant and stunning way. But still, there's that fear there. How can we know? What if I choose wrong? What if I choose wrong? What if I choose the wrong path? Later on in the same chapter of Psalm, verses 23 and 24, says that the Lord makes firm the steps of the one who delights in him. Though he may stumble, he will not fall. For the Lord upholds him with his hand. God will make your steps firm. If you're pursuing him with your choices, if you're pursuing him with your decisions, if you stumble, he's not going to let you fall. He's got you. It's okay. You can choose. And if you're pursuing God, if you believe he exists and he will reward you for your faithful pursuit of him, he's not going to let you fall. You can choose. You can make that decision. Proverbs 16:3 reinforces it and tells us, commit to the Lord whatever you do, and he will establish your plans. He will make them firm. He will establish them. He will root them, commit them to him, and he will take them and solidify them and make them firm. We can trust God with the result. You've heard the expression, I'm sure, practice what you preach. Well, this week, as I was working on this sermon, Katie sent me a text with a question, basically a what do we do? I don't want to make this wrong decision, but it feels like a big one with possibly significant future consequences. There's no way to be certain what decision we should make and what we should do, because both have pros and cons, and that seems significant. How do we make the right choice? And so we talked about it for a while, and we were genuinely unsure about what to do, about either choice. And then I looked down at the story of Moses' birth and the faith of Amram and Jochebed, and what they were teaching me, and the lesson for us here is so clear. In the face of uncertainty, we make a decision and pray over it and trust God to take care of it. I'm convinced that in many situations, we could make either decision in faith. God knows our motives. He knows our heart. He knows our pursuit of Him and our desire to do the right thing. And we trust God, and He will take care of the rest. If we're choosing something that will have clear and obviously detrimental results, and we know it, and then we say, God, please take care of this, that's not faith, it's stupidity. But in uncertain situations where we have choices to make, we have to just trust that God knows the desires of our heart and also knows what's best, and then commit our decision to Him and let Him direct the path from there. That's tough. That's hard. It's like watching your baby being picked out of a basket with the potential of being thrown into the Nile. It's tough. But if we passionately pursue Him, He will reward our righteousness like the noonday sun. It's hard, but I believe that God exists. And I believe He will reward those who are passionately pursuing Him, craving Him, chasing after Him. And so I can trust Him with the result when I act in faith. I can trust Him to make my paths firm when I make a decision in faith. I can trust Him that even if I stumble a little bit, He will grab me and pull me up and not let me fall. And if you believe the same, if you can claim Hebrews chapter 11, verse 6, that He does reward those who believe in Him and diligently pursue Him, then you can find confidence in the faith of uncertainty, in the face of those decisions. You can be just as confident. I'll finish with this. That kind of confidence in believing in God and the pursuit, that kind of confidence can only come from believing that God exists first and that He will reward us, right? That kind of confidence that I can make a decision and it'll be okay only comes from believing that God exists and pursuing Him and believing that He will reward me for my pursuit. And so if you're still trying to work through whether or not you believe in God, what that means to really believe in God, or what it takes to have a relationship with God, to really pursue Him, put it on your comment card. Email me. My email's in the worship guide. Set up a time to talk with me. Catch me after the service, because I want to help you resolve those things, because this I know, because I believe in God, and I am passionately pursuing Him, then we can walk with confidence into the reeds and watch that baby taken out of the basket. We can walk with confidence into a decision and know that God will establish our plans. And you can too. Let's pray. God, thank You for just being there. Thank You for being faithful and willing to work with us. Willing to watch us make these decisions. And I know there are times where You probably want to just push us and put us into the right place, but You let us work through these so we can demonstrate our faith and confidence in You. And so, God, will You help us deal with those struggles and situations that we are all facing right now, some sort of decision. Help us to walk confidently into that, knowing that You will reward us for pursuing You because You exist and love us. And God, if there's still that struggle in our heart about You and who You are, please help us resolve that today. But I love You, God, and I just pray that You will reward our righteousness like You've promised, like the noonday sun. I pray this in Your name. Amen.